New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics. I am your host, Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University, and I'm today exactly in Oxford because the author of this book that I'm presenting today is here to give a seminar, to give a paper exactly on the topic of the book. The author is Pasquale Tridico, which is professor of political economy at Roma Tre University in Italy, and the book, which has just been published by Routledge in 2017, is titled Inequality in Financial Capitalism. Welcome, Pasquale.
Welcome.
Let's go through the index of this book. There is part one, definitions, approaches and origins of income inequality. Part two, financialization and financial crisis, policies and empirical evidences. And then we have some conclusions. And by the way, today we also celebrate that a paper on the same topic has just been published by Cambridge Journal of Economics. So the paper is now published and the title is Determinants of Income Inequality.
Yeah, in OECD countries.
In OECD countries. OECD countries is also more or less the basis, the data set of this
exactly,
book.
Exactly, yes.
Well, first of all, let's start with your background, your current affiliation and your background, if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea, for this interview. I'm very honored. So I'm professor of political economy, professor of labor economics in particular. My specialization is more on labor economics. And I am Jean Monnet Chair in economic growth and welfare systems. My research interests focus on inequality, on labor economics, on labor market in advanced economies. And I try to understand in this book and in general in my recent research work the connection between labor market institution and inequality and economic growth as well.
Please, can you tell us, I know that your work has always been around a series of topics that naturally converge to this book, but can you tell us the origin of the book?
Yes, I've been working on inequality and on the foundation of inequality in the past, let's say, since 2010, since I got this wonderful period of as a Fulbright scholar in the United States, so in New York. From that time on, I was curious and I was intrigued by the connection between inequality and the crisis, yeah? So I started to think about the origin of the crisis to be found in the income distribution and therefore in the institution at the basis of income distribution. And one of the most important institutions which regulate income distribution you can find in the labor market in the end. So institution labor of the labor market. So since then, 2010, since this Fulbright, I was writing papers trying to explain the connection between labor market inequality and the crisis. And then I thought that I should do something more overwhelming. Unfortunately, when you write a paper, more often for the needs that we know about how to publish a paper, they need a short paper, they need just one idea. But this issue is a very complex issue. The issue of inequality cannot be explained with a single unequal relation. You know, inequality is connected with financial crisis, yes, of course, but and probably is causing financial crisis. But financial crisis as well is causing inequality. So even if it's a bidirectional relation, you cannot even explore it just in one single paper because, as we know, you have to explore one direction or causality and then you. So the book, in fact, allows you to elaborate more, to write more things, even to speak about European Union. The second part, which is, as you said, more empirically founded evidence and so on, gives you opportunity to speak about policy in Europe, the crisis of Eurozone, which is connected to some extent to uneven development, more in general, broadly speaking. And you can find connection with inequality as well, and with the institution of labor market, which is one of the main arguments, in fact, in the thesis throughout the book.
Well, there is a lot to discuss, and I definitely want to go to the crisis and to your policy recommendations and to the nature of the OECD countries, but maybe in particular to the Italian case. But first, I forgot to tell our listeners that you are the Secretary General of EIEP, which is the European Association of Evolutionary Political Economy, which is the second largest society of economists in Europe and the progressive and pluralist one. And by the way, this association is also the sponsor of this series of new books in economics.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Of course. This is probably this is my my what I like more about my profile. To be to is an honor and it's a duty, and it's a privilege for me to be the general secretary, elected general secretary of the association, of the European Association for Evolution Political Economy. Most of my paper I developed within the conference, at the conference, or at the annual conference of EIEP. So I was lucky to get wonderful comments from colleagues at this conference in Manchester, in Genoa, in Budapest recently, and then before in Krakow, in Vienna. So this conference, in the last years in particular, when I was working on inequality, were the wonderful outlet, the wonderful places where I could present my book, my papers, and receiving wonderful feedback. I remember from one colleague in particular, we were in Nicosia. I think in Nicosia I got the key of the argument and the link between inequality and how inequality affect the link between inequality and labor market and how labor market institution affect the adjustment during the crisis in order to allow for a reduction of labor share, which then affect the aggregate demand. So I remember that these things were much more clear to me in a panel, in a session in Nicosia, where I discussed these things with many colleagues. I could even mention some of them, but many are open to this alternative explanation, which are not claiming, for instance, as mainstream economics usually does, that inequality either is irrelevant, so it's not important, or sometimes it's even functional to grow. So if there is inequality in the society, this is good because it can lead to higher incentive and better economic growth for countries. So,
well, I definitely agree with you that the labor market is crucial in determining inequality, probably second only to the fiscal system in a country, or probably as important as the fiscal system. I wanted to ask you I forgot to say that we are even co-authoring a paper on inequality, and I work on organizational studies, because now even in management and organizational studies there is an emphasis on going back to study inequality. So this is trending not only among economists but also among other social scientists, and definitely it is a hot topic in EIEP conferences, but also even in our management conferences it is places where you often find papers, if not entire tracks, devoted to inequality. Okay, so we know where the books come from. We know what are the ambitions, the goals. Let's say something about the data set and the data that you have used on your model, but also what are the main ideas behind this book.
Okay, yes. Okay, I will start about the main ideas and go into the data, yeah? More than, of course, institution, labor market institution, and reduction of the wage share are the cause, let's say, that then lead to inequality. But I think there is something even more important, Andrea, which is the ideological paradigm, the political economy paradigm, the economic model which allows for an increasing of inequality in today's economy. So the main idea, in fact, comes from that, and it is rooted in the fact that since the 80s we had a new theoretical paradigm, a shift from a different socioeconomic model, which did not allow for that increase of inequality, towards a new economic paradigm where finance is the leading factor and where ideas, tolerance towards inequality become easier, meaning that today we are able in the society to tolerate higher level of inequality, first of all, and second, policy are free crucial factor which allows to inequality. I strongly believe that inequality is a matter of policy. It's a social choice. It's a matter of institution. It's a matter of the choices that government and state do when they speak about income distribution. So the theoretical paradigm, which started in the 70s, finance as the leading factor, so the growth benefiting mostly the finance, was detrimental, in fact, for the wage share, for the income distribution, allowed for an increasing of income inequality. In this context, what I call the financial capitalism emerged as the model to be fed. And how you can feed the model which is leading finance as a main factor? Through the increasing of rent, the increasing of dividend, the increasing of the profit share vis-a-vis the stagnation or the reduction of the wage share. So in this context, in this ideological context, which emerged between 70s and 80s, we had policy which then affected negatively the income distribution, the increase of income inequality.
Okay, well, probably at this point I should warn our listeners, maybe the non-specialists only need to be warned of this, that you might have different opinions on the role of finance, you might have different opinions on how labor markets should be regulated, and also you might even have different opinions on the nature of inequality. So whether it is something acceptable to some extent, in particular if you are a developing country or not. And also, of course, there are different opinions on even on the nature of on the trends of inequality. For example, not everybody agrees that there is a univocal trend in inequality. For example, I might argue, if I wanted to be the devil's advocate, that inequality among countries, it is probably growing. This is true in developing countries, but also in the Western countries. While at the same time, inequality between nations has been decreasing. Mm-hmm. So the difference between Europe and Asia, for example, is narrowing down.
You're right. I would probably agree on this second statement, not on the first, meaning that. But this inequality between countries is decreasing, but this is mostly due to some countries, to some important big countries like China, like India, like this. BRIC economy, so four or five countries in total which are growing more than the rest, and these have an important weight at world level, so that inequality decreases. But let's come back to the nature of inequality, Andrea. You know, we are not speaking here about difference among wages due, for instance, to what we can call human capital, you know? There are differences among workers which are in a way functional to the good function of the society. If you invest in human, if you go to school, if you invest in your human capital, it's correct in the end to have an higher premium and rewards in terms of wage, which would incentivate more. Otherwise, people will not study, ignorance would prevail, human capital would be frustrated. So it's not this at the stake in my book. What is at the stake of my book? What is the inequality which is questioned is in fact the huge difference that today we are experiencing. Just to give you some numbers, before you ask me about data and so on, how we can tolerate today that the 85 people in the world have an amount of wealth which is roughly the amount of 3.5 billion people in the world. So half of population in the world have the same wealth of 85 people, the people like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Carlos Slim, and etc. Data from Oxfam, but as well from OECD, from World Bank, from standard international organization testify this huge difference. So, and what is the problem about this data? It's not only a moral issue. It's not only a problem of social injustice. It's a problem of correct function and development and growth of the society. When few people have such a big amount of income, of wealth, and having these people, as Caldo already taught us, a very low marginal propensity to consume, what they do, in fact, is that they consume a small fraction of this income, and they save most of this income. They save in paradise, in fiscal paradise, in the worst case, or even in the bank, in the corner bank, in ordinary case. This money are not even going towards investment in order to become productive. Very often they remain in this paradise, or they are invested in portfolio movement in the financial sector. Instead, if most of this wealth would be distributed among people who, according to Kaldor, again, under this post-Keynesian tradition, they have a marginal propensity to consume close to 80%, 90%. If average worker in Europe earning 1,500, 2,000 euro, what they do with what? They spend all what they have for living. So the marginal propensity to consume would boost the dynamics of the aggregate demand. And the dynamic of the aggregate demand would boost the dynamic of growth. Instead, we are in a trap with most of the resources which are amassed in a few hands and are not put in the system to boost aggregate demand dynamics and growth. So this is an economic problem.
Yeah, perfectly.
And the economy should be very...
I perfectly agree. I have to say that this book clearly is not neutral in terms of policy, because you have your ideas, you have very, very strong ideas, so it's not neutral, but it's not ideological. So you don't have a moral argument for fighting against inequality. You have an economic argument, which is aggregate demand, as you said. But what I usually say to my students is that there is an efficiency argument in favor of inequality, because if you don't have women in the labor market, or if you discriminate, or if you don't have social mobility, this is just not good in terms of efficiency of the markets. So there is a very, very even neoliberal argument for the efficiency of market, which should go towards equality and inclusion of women in the labor market.
Yeah, I agree on that. And you know, for many decades, we were living with the idea, with the Kuznets paradigm, that inequality was to some extent justified up to some extent. And then when countries were becoming richer, this was functional to the growth. And after they become richer, they decrease inequality, a sort of trickle-down effect, which was then very much popularized by Reagan and Thatcher administration later. What we are experiencing today, in fact, is the opposite. We are experiencing not a U curve, we are experiencing an S curve, meaning that inequality depends actually on what you do in terms of policy and institution. Look at the wage share in many advanced economies.
You want to say something more about this Kuznets curve to the listener? Maybe they are not familiar with it, and they couldn't visualize it.
Kuznets was mostly predicting a path, like a reversed U, where you have an increasing of inequality in the first phase of development, when countries become rich. Yeah. But this was exactly not happening when we were becoming industrialized, for instance, Italy, but all continental European countries, even the United States, when they increased, the average income increased very much. Middle class was getting better and better. So inequality was not increasing during the first phase of development. What we are experiencing today, in fact, instead, is that inequality increased since the 80s, since the end of 70s. So once we already became richer, Italy became richer after the boom, the economic boom, for instance, Italy, but I could say Germany, France, the UK. Well, in the case of UK, of course, it's a bit different since it was the first industrialized country. But anyway, in the first phase of development, this is a continental European country, become richer with lower inequality. Now they are richer. Now that they are richer, inequality is decreasing. Kuznets was not saying that. It was saying that inequality was increasing in the first phase, and then in the second phase, they were distributing resources and inequality was decreasing. And we are not experiencing that. If you look at the wage share in many advanced economies, like Germany, like Canada, like France, like Japan, United States, or Ireland. Ireland is the worst case, yeah? They, just before the crisis, just before the 2007 crisis, this country, in particular Ireland, experienced a huge reduction of wage share. Ireland, as we all know today, was part of the so-called pigs, as non-good, I mean, as a bad country, bad in terms of performance, who had a very bad performance and then a very big crisis in 2007-08. And this is mostly due, I think, to the reduction of wage share that this country experienced. The case of Ireland is even more interesting for another reason, which has to do with financial capitalism. What I argue is that during the decreasing of the wage share and the decreasing of wage in general, credit consumption was substituting aggregate demand. Yeah, was helping aggregate demand. Because in the end, in an economy, you need aggregate demand in order for the economy, in order for the firms in order for the product, for the demand to absorb what the firm produce. Now, in Ireland or in UK or in US, but in Ireland in particular, credit consumption was very developed just to compensate this reduction of wage share, which was decreasing very much before the crisis. And in fact, we had a country which was completely indebted from a private point of view. I'm speaking about private indebted, which I consider much more worrying than the public debt, as far as there is a central bank behind the public debt and the government behind the public debt. This is not such a big issue. Look at the case of Japan or the case of the United States. Of course, it becomes an issue if you don't have a government, if you don't have a central bank. Anyway, this is another issue which concerns the Europe, and probably we can speak about that later. But in the case of Ireland, the credit consumption, which increases so much during the reduction of the wage share, just to sustain the aggregate demand. And when the crisis occurred, liquidity shrink. Availability of credit shrank as well, decreased as well. So firms, banks were less keen to lend money during the crisis. So the crisis developed in all its power, let's say. And we could see that once as well the credit consumption was not any longer there, the economy was stuck in a stagnation, a recession, which was very strong.
Yeah, so you talk in this book, you talk about finance and the shift of the role of finance in our individual lives and in the society, and also we might add in the behavior of firms as an element which represents the new paradigm, which is no longer a Fordist paradigm, where the salaries grow with productivity and where there is an exchange between increase in productivity and increase in the salaries. It is no longer happening, and growth and the economy goes predominantly to finance. And as a subset of this, finance itself is trying to support the aggregate demand. This is very clear throughout the book. I don't know, do you want to tell us about the variables that you use to map what is happening?
In the end, I made a model, I mean a boring econometric model to show some connection, some causality between the dependent variable, meaning the inequality, and the factor which caused it. So in this model basically there are few variable. One is financialization, measured as capital market value, meaning the price multiplied by the share of all the firms listed in the stock exchange in a given year. So the increasing of financialization in this way, measured as a proxy, of course, has a negative impact on inequality. The APL, which is the index for and the temporary works, which is an indication for labor flexibility. So the higher the labor flexibility, the higher the temporary works, the lower the temporary work, the higher the inequality, and the higher the flexibility, the higher the inequality. So this is another variable that I use in my variable. Another important variable is the trade union density. So in the context of globalization and of financial capitalism, in fact, trade union really lost power. Firms' capital, in a way, won the battle against labor in this context. We can observe our trade union density reduced very much, unionization reduced very much, and this affects negatively inequality. And last but not least, social spending. So countries which resisted to this tendency in the end are the countries which invested more in welfare. So welfare is not a barrier to economic growth, but instead is actually good not only for reducing inequality, but it's good as well to boost economic growth. So I think that these are the most important variable that I use in my discourse.
From your economic model, can you argue which one is the most powerful? Either financialization, employment protection legislation going down, trade union density, or public social spending? Which one is the most powerful in explaining?
Well, I think that there is a strong interaction among all. I think that if I have to pick two, basically, one is would be difficult, but the most important interaction goes between financialization and labor flexibility. I think that these two are the most important. Financialization, because gives most of the growth to the financial class, which is the new patrimonial society in today's economy, and labor flexibility because it allows this adjustment of structure of needs of firms to the to the needs of the economy, to the shrinking of the working size. So basically, there is a strong correlation between labor flexibility and financialization. Financialization needs labor flexibility in order to adjust to the change that the firms need in a very quick, in a very efficient, from the firm perspective, way. But labor flexibility allows for a reduction of labor cost, allows for a compression of labor, allows for a reduction of wage share. So that's why it is two variables. I think the most important variable which explain most of the growth in the model in the past three decades at least. So labor flexibility and financialization.
I don't know, maybe I shouldn't make this question because this would require a day of workshop to answer. But for example, if we talk about Italy, I don't believe that there is a very high financialization at the moment. I don't even believe that the employment protection legislation has really gone towards flexibility. I don't even believe that the trade union is so weak. And finally, clearly, we don't have a weak public social spending. So why inequality is still high in Italy and growing?
Well, inequality is high in Italy. It's not the highest. In the highest, you would find, for instance, UK, you would find the US, you would find Ireland, you would find Australia, you would find, Australia as well. You would find Japan. So Italy is in a bid position. And differentialization is in a mid position. Inequality in Italy increased very much in the past 10 years, since 2000, since the end of 90s, so 15 years. In the same period, in fact, if you look at the delta of the variation of labor flexibility, not at the level, but at the variation, since 1997, as we all know, inequality increased very much and labor flexibility increased very much. Then we had two types of labor flexibility which was introduced in Italy in the past 15 years or more, 20 years in a way, since the mid-90s. First, in labor flexibility in entrance, meaning that freedom of firms to hire workers in the way they wish, with 1 day contract, with 1 year contract, with 1 month contract. And then in the last very reforms, in the very last reform that we introduced in Italy, we had introduced as well flexibility in exit, meaning that freedom to fire in a much more easier way. So this combination of the two is very dangerous is for the power of trade union, for the reduction of wage share, because you adjust labor as you want. There is an economist in Italy which I like very much, which just released some measure about Italy. 70 billion per year are transferred from labor share to the capital share in the last three decades since 1990, so almost three decades. So 70 billion per year are transferred, so basically are not going to the labor income, and this means that the consistency of the consumption, the consistency of the aggregate demand is very weak. And moreover, if these 70 billion are not invested but are saving or going to abroad or are going somewhere else, the negative impact, or even if just a small fraction of the 70 million is not going back in the system but is going to somewhere else in saving, the negative impact on growth will be very, very important. Today, more and more economists are speaking about secular stagnation. This is again at stake. Not only inequality, but as well lack of growth we are experiencing, because this model does not only causes the increase of inequality, but it allows as well the lack of economic growth, the stagnation of GDP. And I think that this has to do with the excess of saving. But the excess of saving is a consequence of income going to the richer part of the society. As Kaldor again taught us, if you have excess of saving, it means that wages are too low. It means that richer are getting a huge amount of amount and they are saving what they get, because the marginal propensity of richer in terms of saving, in the marginal propensity of saving of richer is much higher than the worker, of course. So the secular stagnation, which may be a consequence of an excess of saving of investment, is however, a consequence of this uneven income distribution.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the stagflation, and this triggers my plan to ask you about the crisis, the financial crisis. So the stagflation is somehow what we are now assuming as the norm after our 10 years of crisis, although there are some positive figures in Europe in the past 12 months in particular. So now, what is the relationship between this book, the crisis, and also the protest movements? For example, for several years we have been observing the rise and decline of the Occupy Wall Street movements. So is there a message from this book for people that have been complaining and protesting for the rise of inequality, and for those that were hoping that the crisis would trigger a rethinking of our capitalist model or our regulation of the market? What is the message that this book brings?
Thank you for this question, because it allows probably the discussion to become more political. No, let me answer in this way. For decades, for many years, we thought that since the dominant message was the Kuznets curve, we thought that inequality was not a problem. Probably was sometime good. The Occupy movement, which has to do as well with the increasing of conscience among people that inequality is too high, and inequality is an issue as well for the economy, is an important negative element of the economy, shows that in fact tolerance of inequality among people is decreasing, meaning that we become more sensitive, we start to complain more. And for a while, I thought that many books, since the Piketty book, but as well before with Atkinson in particular, who was the pioneer of this studies in income inequality, the message finally reached the people. With the financial crisis, people started to question that the crisis was not originated by the superficial subprime crisis which emerged after the Lehman and Brothers crisis in 2007, but was more structural, so had to do with the income distribution. So people started to realize this more and more. Occupy movement, but as well protest parties in Italy, in Germany, in Austria, in UK. I think that in many countries, this protest movement or these parties had to do as well with the uneven income distribution within the society, within advanced economy, within the wealth society of the old time. So I think that there is a message here, which is be aware of inequality, because it is not only a social issue, it is a detrimental economic issue for the growth, for the development of a country.
Yeah, definitely this has been a hot topic, not only among the protesters, but also among many governments, or at least many parliaments. This has been debated. Many countries established commissions, inquiry commissions on the matter. We tried also to measure our GDP, or to try to give to our governments different type of targets, different type of objectives, but not much has happened. Not even the book by Piketty, after all, has triggered very, very much.
You're right. This is unfortunate. It is like that, and I will not. I don't know what would be the answer to your remark. So there was a protest. Then this protest was not able to be transformed in political action, in policy, in institution, in change, in reversing policy. There were some very weak change in some countries, but not enough to reverse the moment. I think that most of, probably, I'm not a political science here, so I will just make some intuition, some guess, but not giving a definite answer. Most of most of the ineffective policy have to do probably with the fact that in the same period that after the crisis, many advanced economies, rich economies, are experiencing another important issue, which is migration. I think that there was a confusion here. There was migration and terrorism. These are two issues that often wrongly are put on the same side. So they are attracting the attention of many governments in the last years. And in particular, Some people even think that the emergence of this issue, migration and terrorism, in this big dimension, or probably in this big number that we are observing today, is overwhelming, is taking the, is functionally taking most of the attention of the government, which are not any longer dedicating attention as it used to be in 2007-8, just after the crisis with the Occupy movement and so on, are not any longer giving the proper attention that this issue of inequality would deserve.
This is true. This is perfectly true.
So probably this would be. But in the end, if what is migration? Migration is generated by inequality. Many studies shows that the Arab Spring was not only a political demand of freedom, but was generated by the level of inequality that in those countries there was. So people started not any longer to tolerate this inequality. And then civil war started everywhere. And then this country are living now in a situation of crisis, of political trouble, of civil war, and then the flow of migration become as a consequence, as a natural consequence. So I think that this may be an explanation of the fact that today, unfortunately, and probably instrumentally, this government not giving proper attention.
Well, for example, with respect to the hot topics changing, I remember when I was at school, a hot topic for solving Italian economic problems, I remember it was many people were talking about vocational training. And then when I went to university, the emphasis shifted to research as a priority. And then we started talking about productivity as a big problem. And then the debt and the monetary issue became a hot topic. Now you're right, everything is forgotten and we are talking about migration. But this brings me exactly to two issues, which is Trump and Brexit. Because you said yes, we are no longer, not only inequality is no longer a priority, but we are going backwards. For example, Trump is trying to dismantle the Obama healthcare plan, which is a big step towards equality, and also he's trying to go back in the regulation of the financial industry in the United States, giving again more power and more freedom to the financial institutions. So we are going back 10, 15 years. If it's successful, but probably it will not be. And the same is happening with Brexit, because leaving the European Union probably would work for them, for the British industries, only if they are able to challenge some of the European regulation. And the European regulation, I can challenge you on this, has created the best environment in the world with respect to environmental, social, occupational, and consumer regulation. And so if you want to fight against the European Union or become a champion in trade worldwide, you need to decrease your standards.
Yeah, Andrea, you raise two hot issues, two important questions, which of course are not analyzed in my book, but of course they need to be addressed. Probably you are right when you say that Trump is going back. So Trump used, first of all, the point is the following, I think. Trump used a rhetoric which made appealing, which appealed in particular the poor, the income, the middle class, the people who were experiencing such a reduction of wage share. But now what he's going or is planning to do is would worsen the situation of these very same people that they voted. You mentioned, of course, the Obama medical care. You mentioned the Frank Dot Act regulation introduced in 2010 by Obama, which, of course, better than what it was before. And if we are going back to before the Frank Dot Act, which was not the best, but still was something. And if we are going before the Obamacare, which was not the best, but still was something, of course, it is worsening the income distribution and non increasing. Similar with UK, with the Brexit. Many people put the issue of the Brexit on commercial issue, put the reason, try to explain the reason of Brexit from a commercial point of view. But be frank, UK was in a wonderful position in Europe. It was not part of the Eurozone, which probably would be the one which make more constraint to member state. Was part of a free trade, which where it aimed always to be. Remember that UK always in the 60s aimed to be member of, and the, of the Eurozone. And the goal, and the goal twice say no, because he knows probably, he knew probably the ambiguous position of UK as far as agreement with Europe was concerned. So when finally they entered, having UK now not manufacture any longer, they will not lose anything. Basically, having mostly financial industry, which is more competitive, more efficient than any other country in Europe, they will just win in the free trade zone. So in the European Union, UK would just win, I think, from this perspective, from the perspective of financial capitalism model. Yeah, of course, it will not win. Probably will not be people of UK will, without outside of the financial sector, are not winning, of course, because in this country, I think that there was a strong reduction of wage share of people outside of the financial sector. Financial sector compensation increased everywhere, and in particular in the country which have most of this financial sector, meaning UK and US. But UK and US have as well other people not working in the financial sector, and these people are losing. So on these people, the rhetoric of the Brexit was very functional. So they, for a very wrong reason, associated the decline of the industrial sector in UK to the Brexit for some reason, which is not, of course, justified, because there is no link between the two. It was a matter of choices in the 70s and the 80s by government in UK, and first and notably by Margaret Thatcher. Yeah. The industrialization, I mean. And this affected negatively the people in the north, the people outside of London, the people outside of the financial sector. These people today were ready for some reason, probably this has to do with migration again, they associated with European migration to European Union, they associated to that the loss of income that they experienced. But this has nothing to do, probably. Has nothing to do with the European Union, with the single market of which UK was part.
So this was a digression, but my point was that I would like you to measure what happens to the British economy, to measure what will happen in Britain after they leave the European Union in terms of inequality. And by the way, if they ever manage to leave the European Union, because at the moment it seems a very difficult challenge. Okay, I think probably we have discussed about a lot, and it seems a very interesting conversation. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it. Thank you very much for being here, Pasquale.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Thank you.
Now we move to my university, and we go to repeat the show with a seminar in front of my students and my colleagues. And so thank you very much twice for being here in Oxford and for being a host of New Books in Economics.
Thank you.